Today's episode of Suspect Convictions is brought to you by the podcast This Sounds Serious. For a humorous look at the true crime genre, download This Sounds Serious wherever you get your podcasts.
Show me a case where I missed it. They can't show me a case.
He performed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of autopsies annually in a private morgue where the governing entity, the National Association of Medical Examiners, says that any individual performing autopsies should essentially do no more than 250 to 275 autopsies per year.
And there have been various points throughout, throughout the last, 20 years or so, where it's become clear that, bite mark analysis is bogus.
The villains, the sort of bad guys, were those two folks, but that really is an oversimplification of a much broader problem.
My issue is cause of death and manner of death. The medical reason they died, the classification of it, and collection of evidence.
They've actually accused me of manufacturing evidence. That's a crime.
This is Scott Reeder, creator of Suspect Convictions. Recently, I read the book, The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, a book about perceived problems with autopsies and forensic investigations in Mississippi, which the authors, Radley Balco and Tugger Carrington, contend resulted in innocent people being wrongly convicted of murder. The book was an engaging read and touches on many issues that I hear from defense attorneys across the nation. They contend that junk science or questionable forensic techniques are used by prosecution witnesses to obtain convictions. Carrington is director of the Innocence Project at the University of Mississippi, and Balco is an opinion journalist at the Washington Post. Anyone who routinely listens to this podcast knows my commitment to see the wrongly convicted freed. But somehow, when I read this book, I felt we weren't hearing the entire story. So I not only interviewed the authors, but I also reached out to Dr. Stephen Hain, the so-called Cadaver King, and Dr. Michael West, the Country Dentist, to join the podcast as well. Here is how Amazon describes this book. After two three-year-old girls were raped and murdered in rural Mississippi, law enforcement pursued and convicted two innocent men, Kennedy Brewer and Levin Brooks. Together, they spent a combined 30 years in prison before finally being exonerated in 2008. Meanwhile, the real killer remained free. The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist recounts the story of how the criminal justice system allowed this to happen and how two men, Dr. Stephen Hain and Dr. Michael West, built successful careers on the back of that structure. For nearly two decades, Hain, a medical examiner, performed the vast majority of Mississippi's autopsies, while his friend Dr. West, a local dentist, pitched himself as a forensic jack of all trades. Together, they became the go-to expert for prosecutors and helped put countless Mississippians in prison. But then, some of those convictions began to fall apart. First, let's hear what the book's author, Tugger Carrington, has to say about the investigation.
Well, in the author's note, I think Riley can correct me if I'm wrong. In the author's note, we say that Dr. Stephen Hain and Dr. Michael West are the quote-unquote bad guys. But I think in the very next sentence or two, we also take pains to make clear that if it hadn't been them, it would have been somebody else. Maybe not in the exact same iteration, maybe not with, all of the same motivations and what have you. But our argument is that the setup or lack of it, of the state's medical legal system combined with other things, meant that there was a vacuum / opportunity that was ripe for somebody or some entity or some combination to take advantage of at the expense of you know, public health generally and criminal justice more particularly. And then, you know, as you sort of gradually move down the spectrum to, you know, at the cost of the correct outcome in specific cases. So the villains, the sort of bad guys, were those two folks, but that really is an oversimplification of a much broader problem.
Radley, can you give me an example of how you believe the system failed?
So kind of the most notorious example was there was a case where a 13-year-old boy was on trial for murder in Mississippi, and the prosecution's theory was that the boy and his sister had teamed up to kill the sister's husband, waited until he was asleep, and then held the gun and simultaneously pulled the trigger together. And Hayne testified on the stand that he could tell by the bullet wounds that there were two people holding the gun that fired the bullets, which is preposterous. I mean, there's just no science that says you can make that kind of determination. And yet the kid was convicted, and the Mississippi Court of Appeals upheld the conviction, and the state Supreme Court even upheld the conviction until one justice wrote a pretty blistering dissent, and it was enough to make his colleague kind of reconsider their votes, and they ended up throwing out the conviction. But, you know, in these cases where he's given really, Hayne tended to kind of cover his tracks. He would give sort of the prosecution just enough to kind of go on to push whatever theory they're pushing, but he would give himself plausible deniability. So if somebody called him out later, he could say, well, I didn't say that. I just said it was consistent with that happening. With the prosecutor kind of ran with it.
But Dr. Hayne said this is a mischaracterization of his testimony.
They made some outrageous comments. They said that I could look at the Tyler Edmonds case. You probably know they're quoting that, where I looked at an entrance gunshot wound and could tell that how many fingers were on the trigger. I never made any such comment in my life. Absolutely didn't make that comment. And then they said that I screwed up bite mark cases. I don't do bite mark cases. I'm not qualified.
But the author's criticism seems to go to a broader issue, essentially that the prosecution expert witnesses present their testimony in a manner pleasing to district attorneys because they want to be retained for future cases. In Mississippi and in many other U.S. states, each county elects a coroner who is responsible for investigating deaths. Coroners hold a peculiar role. They are charged with confirming and certifying the death of an individual within a jurisdiction. These individuals are politicians, not medical doctors. In the movie The Wizard of Oz, the coroner of the Munchkins was responsible for declaring the Wicked Witch of the East dead after a house fell on her.
As mayor of the Munchkin City, in the county of the Land of Oz, I welcome you most regally.
But we've got to verify if regally.
To see.
If she is morally, ethically,
spiritually, physically,
positively, absolutely,
undeniably, and reliably dead.
Since coroners are rarely physicians, they often hire medical doctors to perform autopsies in cases where wrongdoing is possible. Just who is hired to perform the autopsies is left up to each coroner to decide. For a while, Mississippi had a state medical examiner available for coroners to use. This pathologist was based in the state capitol and employed by the state. The first two medical examiners had relatively short tenures. Stephen Hayne was hired for the job in 1987, but quit after 8 months. He then started a business doing much the same work he had done for the state.
So, you know, instead of being paid on a salary, if you were paid on a piece-by-piece basis like Dr. Hayne was, per autopsy, you could make, you know, in the millions or around a million, but that doesn't include your time for travel and testimony. And Dr. Hayne had at least claims to have had a couple of other full-time jobs. So I think one motivation for anyone, and this goes back to your initial question, would have been money. There was a lot of money to be made, and that creates an incentive arguably, but I think a clear incentive relative to the salary that would have been offered for the government job. It offers an incentive that can be a threat to objectivity, among other things.
The volume of autopsies Dr. Hain performed in private practice was remarkable.
The most obvious answer is that he agreed to take part in a system that was broken, which is to say there was no medical examiner in the state of Mississippi for a couple of decades. And what that allowed to happen was essentially the setup of a fee-based operation, which incentivized many of the wrong things. And what Dr. Hain did sort of most notably to people would be he performed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of autopsies annually in a private morgue where the governing entity, the National Association of Medical Examiners, says that any individual performing autopsies should essentially do no more than 250, 275 autopsies per year. The name, the acronym for the National Association of Medical Examiners, won't certify a forensic laboratory to those more than that. Dr. Hain was doing, at the peak of his career for several years, was doing 1,500, 1,800 autopsies annually himself. Now, he had help, but that's extraordinary. And, you know, leaving aside everything else, there's simply no way to do that load of work without compromising quality, accuracy, and so on and so forth. And you see the results in some of the cases we talk about in the book. Now, there are other things that Dr. Hain was doing, but for readers and listeners, that is probably the thing that'll stand out initially.
Authors Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington contend that he was able to achieve this volume of work by ingratiating himself with coroners and prosecutors across Mississippi. But Stephen Hain told me his work was consistently objective and accurate. They're saying that you were kind of cavalier on your findings. I mean, that's a pretty horrible thing to say about anybody, let alone a physician. So I thought I'd just ask you.
Show me a case where I missed it. They can't show me a case.
In fact, Dr. Hain has zealously defended himself from critics, winning a $100,000 out-of-court settlement from the New York-based National Innocence Project. At issue is a forensic technique called bite mark analysis, mentioned in autopsy reports. But co-author Radley Balco is dismissive of this.
I guess I would say that I don't think that settlement vindicates him in any way. It's a relatively small amount of money when you consider the cost of litigating a case like that.
Perhaps, not surprisingly, Dr. Hain sees things differently.
Yeah, it cost him $100,000. You know, I don't do bite mark analysis. I'm not a dentist. I don't even do dent identification. That's turned over to a dentist or a forensic odontologist. The coroner calls them in. The report goes to the coroner. Then I'm allowed to put that in the autopsy report, just like toxicology, arson investigation reports. Those things, those become part of the autopsy report. And the district attorney said he would not ask me questions about dental identification because he said I was not qualified. And I have said that repeatedly. I'm not a qualified person to do dental identification and bite mark identification. I don't know how to take molds of teeth. My insurance doesn't cover that. I'm not authorized to do that.
It was bite mark analysis that contributed to the convictions of Kennedy Brewer and Levin Brooks. The two cases are the focus of the book. Here are excerpts of how the Innocence Project described the two cases. In 1992, Kennedy Brewer was arrested in Mississippi and accused of killing his girlfriend's 3-year-old daughter. After waiting in jail for 3 years for a trial to begin, Brewer was convicted of capital murder and sent to Mississippi's death row. In the early morning hours of May 3, 1992, Christine Jackson, the 3-year-old daughter of Brewer's girlfriend, Gloria Jackson, was abducted from her home and raped and murdered. Brewer had spent that evening babysitting Christine and her two younger siblings, who are Brewer's biological children with Gloria. 2 days after Christine disappeared, her body was found in a creek in Noxubee County, about 500 yards from her home. Police suspected Brewer because he had been at the home that night and there was no sign of forced entry. However, a broken window near where the child slept could have provided a point of entry for an intruder. Stephen Hain testified that he had found several marks in the child's body that he believed to be bite marks. Hain called Dr. Michael West, a forensic dentist, to analyze the marks. West concluded that 19 marks found on the victim's body were indeed, and without a doubt, inflicted by Brewer. He further asserted that all 19 were made only by Brewer's top two teeth, and that somehow the bottom teeth had not made an impression. In 2001, advanced DNA testing was conducted on the semen recovered in 1992 from the victim's body. The test produced results excluding Brewer as a possible perpetrator and revealed an unknown male profile. The prosecution conducted further testing on the two of Brewer's friends, who were also excluded. Why? STR testing also excluded many of Brewer's relatives. No subsequent effort was made to identify the real perpetrator. DNA testing during this investigation led to the implication of another man as the real perpetrator. The unidentified DNA profile discovered in 2001 matched Justin Albert Johnson, one of the original suspects. Johnson was then confessed to Christine Jackson's murder, as well as to an identical crime. The murder of Courtney Smith, committed in September 1990, also in Noxubee County. Johnson assured the investigators that he acted alone in both crimes. 18 months before Brewer was arrested in the other crime, 3-year-old Smith was raped and murdered and left in a pond near her home. The ex-boyfriend of the child's mother, LaVon Brooks, was charged and convicted in large part on the strength of the bite mark analysis performed by West. Just as in Brewer's case, Hain, the medical examiner, called into West to analyze the bite marks on the child's wrists. West testified the marks were human bite marks consistent with LaVon Brooks' top two teeth. On February 15, 2008, charges against Kennedy Brewer were dropped and he was exonerated. On the same day, the Innocence Project, along with Mississippi Innocence Project co-counsel, won Brooks' release from prison. Brooks was subsequently exonerated in March 2008. The case has raised questions about the scientific validity of bite mark analysis. Radley Balco is among the technique's harshest critics.
I don't think that's an excuse. I'll just be quick and let Tucker rant. I think the bite mark analysis there have been critics of it from the start, almost from the very start, and certainly by the time Brewer and Brooks were convicted, there were people who were raising red flags about it. The fact that they never actually went to any actual scientists to ask them to look into this field. West wasn't a scientist, he was a dentist. Published, the places where he published his various articles were law enforcement journals and criminal justice journals, not sort of peer-reviewed academic, scientific journals. And there have been various points throughout the last, 20 years or so where it's become clear that bite mark analysis is bogus.
But Dr. West stands by his work and the underlying science.
One way or the other, here in the last 30, 40 years, I went through 16,000 death investigations, 5,800 autopsies. I would hazard a guess to the murdered infants that I've seen. It kind of brings to your mind, don't listen to the ones that badmouth you, and don't listen to the ones that praise you. You have to judge yourself. And one side has an agenda, the other side has an agenda, and what might be right might not be popular, and what's popular might not be right.
Are Are you a fan of narrative-driven podcasts but are looking for something that's funny? Why not check out a new podcast from Cashbox called This Sounds Serious, The Case of Daniel Bronstadt. This show pokes fun at the mystery and crime genre in an amazing way because it delivers big on both laughs and story. This will become your new Can't Stop Listening To podcast because it's truly unlike anything you've ever heard before. Download This Sounds Serious wherever you get your podcasts. This Sounds Serious is a Cashbox original produced by Vancouver-based creative studio Kelly & Kelly. It is a fake true crime podcast, and it delivers both on laughs and stories. It stars Peter Olding of Dexter Gulf is Smarter Than You and Carly Pope of Arrow, Suits, and Elysium. The first two episodes are available May 1st, wherever you get your podcasts. The series moves beyond parody by telling a compelling serialized story. Each episode is about 25 minutes long, perfect for a commute or a road trip. Go to www.thissoundserious.com. And folks, at the end of this podcast, you can listen to a trailer for This Sounds Serious. The newspaper in Jackson, Mississippi, the Clarion Ledger, reported that West said, "I no longer believe in bite mark analysis. I don't think it should be used in court. I think you should use DNA. Throw bite marks out." But Dr. West said this is a mischaracterization of his statement.
There was a beautiful editorial cartoon just a couple months ago. It was a man and a woman sitting on a sofa staring at TV. And the woman says, "This article says that men only hear what they want to hear." And the man says, "Well, yes, darling, I'd love another beer." They want to hear what they want to hear. They didn't ask me, you know, he said, "Do you believe that you could bring bite marks into court and blah, 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 and use the system?" I said, "No, I wouldn't bring bite marks into court." Well, damn, that's what they wanted to hear. They didn't ask me why. And the why was that they can literally accuse you of anything and don't have to back it up. They've accused me of being stupid, being wrong. They've actually accused me of manufacturing evidence. That's a crime. They got their opportunity in front of a federal judge to lay down all this evidence that they have. Do I want to go into a court of law, be sworn in, and present evidence and then an opinion about that evidence and then spend 10 years in court for my efforts? I don't think so. The whole system, you know, is not the best system in the world. I mean, it's not perfect, but I do think it's the best system. The judges, for the most part, are afraid to put any reins on the defense. So it allows them to make any accusation you want to make, whether it's backed up by any evidence or in anything. I don't want to go swimming that pool anymore. Do bite marks work? Yes. What are they? They're just tool mark analysis on skin, the tool being teeth. What is your opinion? Did these teeth leave that mark on this skin? Yes or no? Or where are you in between? I mean, it's not rocket science.
This, of course, raises the question of whether a faulty forensic technique contributed to the wrongful convictions of Kennedy Brewer and Levin Brooks. Dr. West's thoughts are unique.
Now, this Kennedy Brewer guy, they brought us a little girl. She was 3 years old, raped, murdered. She had injuries on her hands and arms and such that were vital reactions. In other words, they had turned reddish, swollen, wheel and erythema for the medical term. We documented all of those. And this was basically the county force all the, you know, this was a new thing. They spent a lot of money getting this all together and presenting it in court. And when it was over, he polled the jury. He goes and talks to them and says, you know, why did you vote guilty? What did you think of this? And they all said they didn't really care too much for the bite marks because you had one doctor said it was, one doctor said it wasn't. He said, well, why did you convict him? He says, well, the day after the girl was missing, the police arrested him and went back to his house, had some clothes, and had the hound dog smell the clothes and cut the hound dogs loose. Well, the hound dogs ran, I can't remember, something like 100 or 300 yards, something like that. And they come to a body of water, a pond or a stream. And damn, there's a little girl's body. Now, he knew that, but he still wants to get this man out of prison because he can't stand the death penalty. LaVon Brooks, same thing, bite mark, vital reactions on the injuries of the girl. Why was he convicted? He said, well, they didn't care about bite marks. There was one guy said it was, one guy said it wasn't. They didn't understand. But what they did was impressed with was the fact that the dead girl had a little sister, a year or two older than her, and she said, the woman came in the bedroom after midnight and picked up my sister and went off with her, and that was the last we ever saw of her. That's why he got convicted. Now, they couldn't sue the little girl. They couldn't sue the hound dogs. So they sued me. And from a death investigator standpoint, number one, if you just look at the odds, mama's baby is left alone with her new boyfriend, and the baby winds up dead. Well, let's give him some slack. 8 out of 10 times it's going to be the boyfriend. If you have a woman that's beaten and murdered and killed, maybe you should look at A, her husband, and B, her boyfriend, and go down that line. You start at that top, you'll hit something real quick. Now, as a death investigator, all the evidence that they compiled against these two men, I believe that they're guilty. Now, as far as the bite marks are concerned, I do believe that A, they bit those girls. B, the girls were alive. That's the two statements I can make about the bite marks. I never testified they killed anybody. I never testified they raped anybody. But I do feel firm that the comparison of their teeth to the skin injuries on these deceased little girls were a match. And I showed it to the jury. I said, don't take my word for it. Look at it. Here's the injury. Here's the teeth set next to them. Do they match up? Yes or no? You make your own mind up.
For his part, Dr. Stephen Hain believes his work contributed to the eventual exoneration of one of the defendants.
My issue is cause of death and manner of death. The medical reason they died, the classification of it, and collection of evidence. And they accused me of convicting the two not-to-be individuals. You know how they were subsequently remanded for retrial? It's based on DNA evidence and badly decomposed bodies. You know, I'm the one that collected the DNA evidence. If it hadn't been for me, it would have been on death row still.
I've been a reporter for 30 years and covered many forensic issues on both a judicial and legislative level. My thoughts of after interviewing and reading these men and reading the book is this is a good example of advocacy journalism. Now, there's nothing wrong with advocacy journalism in itself, but when you read a book like The Cadaver King and The Country Dentist, you should read it with the thought that the authors are advocating a point of view. I've come to believe in the innocence of Kennedy Brewer and Levin Brooks. Why? Well, the semen of an alternate suspect was identified on the body of one little girl using DNA testing. And that man confessed to killing both girls and acting alone. To me, that carries much more weight than bite mark analysis. Is bite mark analysis a legitimate technique? Well, I put a whole lot more stock in DNA testing. And that points to someone other than these men.
This season on This Sounds Serious.
911, what's your emergency?
It's my brother. I think he's dead.
It was, quite possibly, the most confusing case I've ever been a part of.
Well, I guess I do have some splaining to do, because I did get my tips frosted.
We were
way ahead of the boy band thing.
He joined a f***ing cult.
You are going to meet face to face with a murderer.
Plus, it's Florida. Everyone's a criminal there. It's like America's Australia.
Would you want to comb a mini horse?
Now, can you imagine trying to do the weather without saying thunder?
It looked like he was French kissing the waterbed.
Twins. Identical twins.
This Sounds Serious launches May 1st. Download it on CastBox or wherever you get your podcasts.
There was a guy in my cult. He was like, hey, everybody, I think we should kill ourselves. And we were all like, yeah, okay, Todd, you go first.